CEU Medieval Radio, Past Perfect, the talk show about medieval and early modern culture.
Hello, welcome to Past Perfect, CEU Medieval Radio's podcast on everything medieval and early modern. My name is Tinatin Mirjanashvili and I am here today with Levan Dadishvili. Mr. Levan is a professor at the Agricultural University of Georgia and the head of Artes Liberales program, which I graduated to. His education and academic experience are diverse. He studied law, film directing, musicology, and architecture in his undergraduate degrees. He received scholarship of George Soros Foundation and studied 1 year MA at the Medieval Studies Department at the Central European University in 1996-97. He incorporated his medieval studies experience gained at our department in Artes Liberales program, which occurred main instigator to me to appear here. He also was granted with Fulbright scholarship to research in the Northwestern University concerning classical rhetoric and stage acting in the 17th-18th centuries. He, as the head and a professor of the program of Artes Liberales, participates in the various fields such as lecturing the classical rhetoric as well as architectural designing, Latin and ancient Greek, academic drawing and stage acting. His one of the academic interests is the art of rhetoric, so we decided to discuss classical rhetoric and its connection to Middle Ages. Mr. Levan, it is a pleasure to have you here. What can you tell us about the origins of classical rhetoric? If I can ask more precisely, what caused the creation of rhetoric and how did it emerge?
The question is too broad and I'm afraid speaking about everything, not to say anything. So if I miss an important issue, I hope that you draw my attention to the issue. What caused? It's quite a difficult question, and I doubt that anyone can suggest anything beyond conjectures. Historically, the oldest text, extant text, which mentions rhetor, the epic version of rhetor, or English public speaker, or orator in Latin, is Iliad, Book 9, where Phoenix, one of the members of embassy, which was sent by Agamemnon to Achille. I don't know, either draws the argument to Achilles to convince, to persuade, to return to Agamemnon and Achaeans. That short young Achilles, in Greek it sounds miton tereter, emenai prektera tergon. Or, I taught you, presumably, the most valuable two things, speaking of speeches, muton te rhetor, to be a speaker of speeches, of great things. This is the model of epic hero who can not only fight courageously, but also is able to speak. Actually, Iliad is nothing more. Of course, we know what is Iliad from the first line, that it is Fury of Achilles, but, and as commentators used to say, the rest is just episode. But this episode, which is the corpus body of the whole poem, is nothing else than rhetorical speeches of heroes to each other, and that's to say, duels among them. So the whole epic genre consists of these two things, rhetor ton mipon and praeterum tergon. This was also credited in antiquity that Homer, and particularly Iliad, was thesaurus and handbook of rhetoric and included precepts or theory as well for the art. However, the modern scholars are not inclined to think so, let's just say Kennedy, because, for example, Cicero, thinking so, he projected his attitude toward rhetoric and perhaps regarded since the heroes applied rhetorical skills, and even the term rhetor is sparsely used in the text. So therefore, they should have a rhetorical education in some precepts. However, it is quite doubtful, and actually no one knows exactly what was the education of a rhetor. But I think the difficulty, first of all, is associated with the conceptual issue. What we can regard as existence of something or origin of something. Modern scholars incline to think that when we speak about a certain discipline, we must have at hand some precepts or theory at least, if not many. In this regard, perhaps we cannot regard Iliad as the handbook of rhetoric, because we are not sure of the existence of certain precepts or theory. But I think more or no less important is the attitude toward a certain issue, the place which it takes in the picture of world, how far the matter is important for a certain culture. In fact, sometimes some theories are laid down when the tendency of decline appears, in order to somehow conserve or somehow spread the dying culture. And that's why it's very dangerous to draw any strict conclusion. At least we can say that quite cautiously, or even quite boldly, that according to text of Iliad, the tradition, rhetorical tradition, was strong and highly estimated, which is supported not by the line of Book 9, but also by the text itself. However, if we turn to another paradigm, if we are interested in theory, according to Cicero, referring to Aristotle, rhetoric was invented in Sicily by certain Corax and Tisia, who laid down the precepts for the citizens after expelling of the tyrant, because many judicial cases took place. And the citizens used to apply certain skills at judicial cases, at judicial considerations. Of course, there existed certain tradition, and Cicero also mentioned that many before could speak persuasively, but the precept, according to the tradition, was laid first. And perhaps this is not an important issue, because one thing when, for example, one can wear certain clothes or shoes very conveniently, it does not reflect the issue. And another thing when, for example, one reflects that he wears clothes and shoes quite conveniently, and it is somehow is an intellectual or even intelligible reflection of the matter. The same was with the theory of rhetoric, because since Aristotle, because Aristotle's text is the oldest extant text which came down to us, where these theoretic issues, not only precepts but also philosophical insight, is presented verbis expressed. And these some scholars regard that the origin of rhetoric we must trace from Aristotle and the text on rhetoric which followed him. So this tradition includes many primary sources, Greeks as well as Latin, And we cannot speak about one narrow, strict tradition of rhetoric. Certainly, there are some universal issues which can be applied to more or less to all tradition, but there are no less divergences. And also attitudes to theory or philosophy or technical precept to rhetoric. For example, it's regarded, and I think very precisely, that Aristotle's attitude is more philosophical. For example, Cicero's idealist, the author of Ad Herennium, presumably certain Cornificius, attitude is more practical and brief or laconic. And Quintilianus is more, that is to say, stylistically genius. But also can be mentioned, no less interesting, the ends and essence of rhetoric in historical perspective, of course. It's quite difficult to understand when we speak about rhetoric, what is essential, what is rhetoric per se.
Yes, that was my next question. It would be interesting if you tell what is the art of rhetoric essentially.
We can hardly understand its historical perspective if we don't know more or less what is our subject, even in historical perspective. Aristotle defined it, not defined, but described rhetoric as counterpart of dialect. He applied the term antistrophe. Antistrophe is borrowed from drama, Greek drama, and we know that it was associated with chorus, when chorus used to move in opposite direction and also answer strophe. Antistrophe means that. And it can be understood in twofold means. On the one hand, antistrophe is a certain opposition, and on the other hand, it's a certain correspondence, correlate. And this twofold meaning preserved at Plato and Aristotle as well. That on the one hand, as Plato tended to think, it's like cosmetics, unlike medicine, which is more properly ascribed to dialectic or logic. But on the other hand, as in Pythagoras, it also can be used for good purposes, so to call virtuous rhetoric. Aristotle also, as usually, he argues with his master, and also he regarded it as some sort of counterpart of logic, which the both disciplines could, that is to say, fulfill the whole body of argumentation, we can say in such a way. But, for example, in the Socratic tradition, as well as in the Roman tradition, rhetoric was regarded rather as a political discipline that was necessary for a virtuous citizen in order to participate in political and, in the Greek case, in judicial discussion, disputation. Well known and widely accepted definition of rhetoric is ascribed to Hermagoras, which sounds, what should orator do? What should rhetor do? Officium oratoris est de is rebus poste dicere, quae res ad usum civilem, moribus et legibus constituta est sub, cum ascensione auditorum, quae sibi potest. So here are very two important issues, or I would say even three. Firstly, that rhetoric is ad usum civilem, or for civil use. No, of course, with civil must understand in antique sense, which means political, not as the modern mind can understand that for price. As we know, civis, civis means polis, or political unity in modern sense, more or less corresponding state. State is nothing more than unity of civis. As Aristotle said, pleton ton politon. So, ad usum civilem means for political or for public application, and it is confirmed by the next statement, ad usum civilem moribus et legibus constitutae sunt, which are established, founded by the customs and laws, which is not the private domain, which is public domain. Then comes the next very important proposition. Cum ascensione auditorum. According to Aristotle, as we mentioned, it is counterpart of dialectic, but according to Aristotle, the spirit of his text, rhetoric, means by all means to persuade the audience. You can say the art of persuasion. However, what means persuasion is slightly vague, because to persuade someone might mean, not necessarily, but might mean, to use, to apply, let us say, propaganda, or let us say, some hypnotic skill or methods. Is it rhetoric or not? And that is why in Hermagoras' definition comes the next proposition, which states, cum ascensione auditorum, or with assent of audience. And this reservation is very important, that rhetoric must not use all means, which also implies manipulation. Actually, Aristotle mentions that rhetoric affects the rational part of mind, not, let us say, animal part of mind or soul. And this reservation is very important, that rhetoric deals with consent of audience affecting the rational part of his mind. And the last reservation of this definition, quod fieri potest, or quod eius fieri potest. So far, it is possible. So, it's not guaranteed that rhetoric can help rhetoric in achieving his political goal, aim, but it does not mean that rhetoric can apply any. Is restricted by the ends of reaching a sense of audience as far as it's possible. Sometimes, of course, it is not possible because it depends on audience as well. Not only, but also on audience as well. So this political implication actually was very important in Ciceronian tradition, in Roman Republican tradition, and later as well. However, Quintilianus, although he regarded as an ardent follower of Ciceronian tradition, but I think that Quintilianus did more than mere, that is to say, Ciceronian or political attitude, that he formulated educational program that rhetoric, which is benedicandi, along with grammar, or rather opposite, grammar, which is rectendicandi, which is also Ciceronian, together with rhetoric, which is benedicandi, is the universal curriculum of communication, and if one achieves the both, he or she can communicate popular, of course, in political domain, but not necessarily and only in that. For Cicero, it's slightly differently used the issue. For Cicero, as in De Inventione, which he composed in his early ages when he was young, rhetoric itself does not mean anything for Republic, for Respublica. Moreover, if rhetor is skillful in rhetoric, but is not vir bonus, or good or virtuous man, it is even detrimental to know rhetoric and to be eloquent without moral or ethical support. And it would be detrimental for himself as well as for Republic or state. So this moral implication was very important for Ciceronian and the Latin tradition, and also must be taken in view, because when we speak about Latin rhetoric, we must understand that in Republic periods, rhetoric was, according to sources which came to us, rhetoric was viewed as the apparatus, as the means of politicians and politics, however, along with moral foundation. But this tendency was slightly averted, and steadily rhetoric gained slightly, maybe not slightly, but essentially different insight. Firstly, it was associated with imperial milieu, where actually citizens lost its political authority, citizens, and everything was, or most things were in political issues, particularly granted to emperor or his cycle. And on the other hand, development of literary discipline. Not uninteresting to mention that this political attitude, which is already presented at Aristotle, founded the main genres or genera, modern term, genres of rhetoric.
Yes, this was exactly my second question. It would be very interesting if you could tell us about the parts of rhetoric and its significance in antiquity, Middle Ages, or modernity, or in general for the European culture. Being your student, not in the far past, I'm aware that the question and the subject is too broad and may not be relevant for a brief interview. But I put such a broad range of the question rather relying upon your predilections and leaving the freedom of the choice to you to select the most crucial issues than expecting exhaustive answers on all the questions.
I am afraid that I can be simultaneously exhaustive and precise. But I try to focus on some points, not be sure that this my information would be colorly and strongly supported by evidence, because I must somehow generalize, and any generalization always contains certain controversy. Firstly, I would mention that in Hellenistic period, about genres that we mentioned, about forensic rhetoric, which was for court and for judicial cases, in order to prove who is just or who is culprit, which was the most elaborated genre of rhetoric. And as we mentioned, actually, rhetoric take place due to, because of judicial cases. Then we would mention deliberative or deliberativo, or political rhetoric, which aims at persuasion or dissuasion, what is good or bad or detrimental or opposite for political aims. And third branch was demonstrativo, or what is laudable or opposite, what orator must appropriate. After fall of Republic and steadily establishing imperial political regime where the main person, the main authority was autocrat or cosmocrator, the deliberative or political rhetoric declined. However, forensic rhetoric remained because it concerned only court and judicial milieu, and deliberativum also flourished in order to scold or opposite to extol the political figures, such as emperor or close to him official. Moreover, it is the different trend of rhetoric, not for political objectives, but rather for something else. And one of the trends was artistical or literal aspect of rhetoric, which in the late Hellenistic period was quite elaborated. We have several primary sources, treatises, where the rhetorical style was quite elaborated. One of such treatises is Hermogenes on style, who suggested 20 models of rhetorical style, mostly excluding, I would say, one, which is kalos or duty, mostly for practical oratory. But despite the rhetoric was strongly associated with art, and particularly literature and poetry, which found its continuation in Middle Ages in Ars Poetry, is one of the branch of rhetoric. However, from the period of spread of Christianity, rhetoric firstly was great danger, because first Christian had, we can say, twofold attitude towards pagan culture. Many fathers reject the classical and pagan education, and for example, Cyprian states that rhetoric or eloquence is nothing more than pride of vocal ambition, or as Basil Caesarea states, that we don't need a phoneme, that we must state clearly the scripture. And we can continue the list. Many Christian fathers rejected inter alia rhetoric as well as the pagan discipline. But another branch of Christian intellectuals saved rhetoric and even transformed it to Christian needs. One of the figures of such persons is St. Augustine, and particularly, not only, but particularly in his De Doctrina Christiana, on Christian teaching, doctrine, he found new application of rhetoric, which was really new, that it could not be associated by any means to antiquity. That by distinguishing the two type of signs, which are literal signs or signum proprium, and which is figurative sign for Augustine, which is associated for thing, res. So according to Augustine, there are two kinds of res. Sign is a res, is something, is a thing, but res is referring to something else, to some thing, not to itself, but to another thing. So he distinguished two set of res, res ad offendum, or signs or things which are just only for use, that they also have their meaning, but it's not important. Important to what they refer and what they imply, not what they state literally. And res ad fruendum, or things which are ends by themselves. And finally, these are, of course, divine things which are immutable, and of course God himself. And all world turns into res ad utendum, or sign which is just only for use, in order to refer, and I would say, uplift to divine and God. And of course, this particularly in the last two books, 3 and 4, he ascribes this function to rhetoric. that rhetoric through allegory or through his capacity to imply must refer which is beyond and uplift a human to the divine and to God. This tradition, that is to say, Christian exegesis or understanding of scripture, comes from this Augustine, very Augustine tradition. That is one, literal understanding, then allegorical understanding, moral understanding, and fourth, the most important, anagogic understanding, which aims to uplift to Christian, to God, and to divine. And this very tradition was very important for Christian and for medieval Europe, but of course it was not the only tradition, because in 13th century, which is rather, frankly speaking, is associated with the decline of rhetoric, inter alia, among medieval universities, there were two traditions. One, Thomistic or Aristotelian tradition, who, as we mentioned, regarded as a branch, although it was more subordinated to logic, and Augustine tradition. One of the representatives is Bonaventura, who regarded rhetoric as an ancilla, as a means to theology. And these two traditions is traced in medieval Europe and in medieval intellectual life. But concerning the second question, I didn't speak about parts of rhetoric, which is translated usually in English as faculty of classical rhetoric. So in order to understand more deeply what means faculty, actually, what should orator, rhetor, public speaker, as such, must do in order to deliver speech, in order to get acceptance of audience. Firstly, since Hellenistic period, regarded five parts of classical rhetoric. However, Aristotle suggests only three parts. It's understandable why, because the rest two parts is not strongly associated with intellectual conduct. Although Aristotle suggests three parts, which became canonical. First part is inventio, aoresis, or what essentially public speaker must say. He must invent or discover. Actually, this part of rhetoric in Middle Ages was borrowed by logic, although by origin it is associated with rhetoric, not logic. What must public speaker invent? Not too many things. Either arguments, or more precisely, firstly, what he should prove or disapprove. That is why the antique theory elaborated quite complicated teaching about constitution or the statute. Or firstly, must be precisely stated what should be argued, and accordingly to be found the relevant argument. Because this discussion may concern facts, which is causa conjecturalis, or might concern, broadly speaking, definition of the term, as Aristotle says, I took. But does it mean that I steal? So it does not concern factual circumstances, it concerns the meaning of the term. And third causa, legitima, concerns the moral aspect. For example, I did steal, but I steal because of the higher good. Does it exonerate me or not? And also, according to Piero's Inventione, fourth issue, the case of competence. For example, as we know, Orestes killed Clytemnestra. For example, there is no discussion about factual circumstances. The both parties agree that Orestes killed Clytemnestra, all factual circumstances agreed, neither concerning the issue of definition, was it killing or not, but the parties discuss concerning whether it is right that son kills mother. But the case is legitimate. Thus, all circumstances that in abstract and in general Clytemnestra deserved killing, thus it exonerates Orestes as her son killing his mother. So here is the case of competence. Who does? Who did? So the first part, shortly and briefly speaking, is eurasia or inventive, invention. Then must be what is invented, organized in some way, which is dispositive. What should be said firstly, then in the middle, and at the end. This issue seems also very important, and not only public oration. I always recall the case of Napoleon. Once he went, took a certain city, called the head of the city and asked, why didn't you ring bells? The head of city answered, because we have several reasons. Please tell all of them. Napoleon. Head of the city answered, firstly, because we don't have any ring at all. Napoleon immediately interrupted him and answered, I am not interested in the rest. Why? Because, presumably, although personally I am interested in the rest, it is more interesting and curious issue, what were the rest really. Why? Because the head of the city begin from the strongest argument, and the rest appeared unimportant. So this is device of the classical rhetoric that is a case of argumentation. One firstly states the strongest argument, weaker in the middle, and again strong at the end. It is understandable perhaps why without explanation. This was called as Homeric disposition. No, actually, I would say not Homeric, but yes, in Iliad, there is such a place when Nestor, the king of Philos, arranged his army in the precisely this way, that the strongest part of army in front, the weakest in the middle, and strongest again at the arrearguard, at the back. So I would call this Nestoric arrangement rather than Homeric. So also we can mention this arrangement concerning the literary text or even films. For example, we usually, not usually, but sometimes can witness the reverse arrangement in films as well, in modern film. For example, this, which is regarded as masterpiece, The Citizen Kane. Also, in the case of Odyssea, we see that the arrangement, the disposition is not in temporal order. So the story takes place in the middle, comes to the beginning, and then reach the end. And that is also very important, from which point we must begin to narrate the story. So, to conclude, inventio concerns argument as well as, in some cases, to compose a story or, as in judicial case, statement of facts, what should orator narrate, and then the second part tells, instructs how should be arranged, which is in Latin dispositio, or in Greek, taxis. What should the orators say firstly, secondly, and third? So, arrangement mainly concerns argument and story because, for example, emotions cannot be invented. Yes, we can narrate about emotions, include in arguments or in stories, but emotions, which is very important for rhetoric, and if we have time, we also speak about affects, emotions. It is the matter of inventing. The matter of inventing a story or argument, and second part, dispositio, how they should be arranged. The third part concerns of style, elocutio. Hellenistic period is very prolific of rhetorical style, and rhetoricians concern, I would say, almost all aspects of style, which sometimes, or the part of which is completely ununderstandable for the modern reader. For example, rhythmical part, which was in Byzantium very important. Or, for example, eighth point, which consonants are, that's to say, mild, and which consonants are harsh, let's say, r. And very important issue about rhetorical tropes and figures. Rhetoric ad herennium, which was wrongly ascribed to Cicero, but since first was Lorenzo Valla who put under the suspicion of the authorship of Cicero, but since the beginning of the 15th century, undoubtedly it was regarded as anonymous, as a work of anonymous. Later it was ascribed, referring to Quintilianus, ascribed to certain Cornificius, who lived between Cicero and Quintilianus. So this ad herennium was one of the main handbooks in Middle Ages before Poggio Bracciolini discovered Quintilianus' full text in 1416, which was a great event among humanists. And this handbook consists of four books. And the fourth book, book four, is completely dedicated to the rhetorical style, which almost equal to the first three books, and describes rhetorical tropes, which are in Ad Herennium 10, and figures. So great importance was put on rhetorical tropes and figures. This also was treated by Aristotle. However, since the Hellenistic period, either Rhodian or Pergamian school was added mnemonics, or artificial art of memorizing, and what is more important, recollection of, in this particular case, text for oral delivery. Perhaps the audience knows the mnemonic, which is very popular in modern days. If I correct, since 1991, there are international contests in mnemonic in modern days, and this art is the one of faculties of rhetoric, namely memorizing by heart the long text. And this is associated with, of course, it's anecdote, it's a legend, nobody knows whether it was historically right or not, according to Cicero, who refers to Aristotle. A certain poet, we know the poet Simoni Chaos from the island Chaos, was invited by a certain rich man, Kopas, who ordered him encomium, laudable speech concerning his participation in horse race. What he did so great in horse racing, nobody knows, but it seems that it was a very important issue for him. And when, and at this party, Simone de Chaos was invited to this party, was paid to deliver the speech, the poem, the encomium rather, laudable speech to the host. However, when the time came, only half of encomium dedicated to Scopas in his racing deeds, and the other part dedicated to Castor and Pollux, the divine brothers, twins. Scopas was angry and said that he would pay only half of the honorar. Of course, this spoiled the mood of Simonides. However, while this party, two fellows called Simonides and get him out from the party. As soon as Simonides left the room, the ceiling fell down and killed everybody who attended the party, symposium. Since death was not very disaster for the Greeks, is witnessed in many texts, not only in Plato, but also in Herodotus, when Solon tells Croesus that gods manifestly showed to the mortals that death is more important than life. But it was very important for Greek to perform the burial ritual, which ought to be done by the close relatives. But the corpse was so mutilated that nobody could identify whose corpse was. And the only person who survived this disaster was Simonides. Legend said that these divine twins paid far more than Scopas did, or in other words, saved Simonides' life. And they asked Simonides to identify the corpse because he attended the symposium. And Simonides went through the marshroute, through the past, and recalled, according to places, whose corpse was who, or belonged to whom in life, of course. And he loved so much that invented the art of mnemonic.
Thank you very much, Professor Levan. This has been the first part of the interview with Professor Levan Tatishvili, and the second part where we discussed the art of mnemonic more precisely and the importance of rhetoric in Middle Ages and medieval universities will be available soon on the site and channel.